was doing the best he can under the circumstances. Lenton reported that even though Kim Il-sung did not agree with Clinton's approach, he was open to the possibility that the young American president was sincere. Graham's phrasing, Lenton discerned, was a polite way for one old man to tell another old man that they were dealing with young men, and that young men can sometimes be brash. This provided an explanation for the U.S. position in a way that made sense to an old village elder like Kim Il-sung, and also served as a character reference for the young United States administration. Once again, Billy Graham's informal diplomacy may have had a significant impact. President Kim made no commitment at the time, but a few weeks later, he formally agreed to allow international inspectors to visit North Korea's nuclear sites. President Kim made no commitment at the time, but a few weeks later, he formally agreed to allow international inspectors to visit North Korea's nuclear sites. In Lenton's view, Graham's explanation provided a motive for allowing the inspections that didn't hurt Kim Il-sung's pride. It made it more a favor that he was bestowing than a concession that had been wrung out of him. Graham's efforts in China did not progress far beyond his earlier visits, but he did visit again briefly in early 1994, just prior to his second trip to North Korea. When Chinese President Jiang Zemin visited the United States in 1997, he requested a meeting with the evangelist in Los Angeles, where they reportedly discussed religious life in both the United States and China, including issues of human rights and religious freedom. As indicated by his government-approved visits to Pyongyang, Billy Graham retained his position as chaplain to the nation and occasional ambassador without portfolio. The media still sought his opinion on matters of state, and he still managed to provide transparent support for his political friends, as when he commended Ronald Reagan in 1991 by observing that one of his greatest achievements was having the wisdom and courage to choose George Bush as his running mate. When the nation proved unwilling to choose his old friend George Bush to fill a second term in the White House, Graham found much to admire in Bill Clinton and was pleased to lead prayers at both of his inaugurations, giving him the distinction of participating in 8 inaugurations for 6 presidents, more than any other figure in American history except John Marshall, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court from 1801 to 1835. Graham maintained his friendship with Ronald Reagan, visiting him on occasion and noting with regret the toll Alzheimer's disease was taking on another great communicator. When Richard Nixon died in 1994, Graham presided over the internationally televised services and also at the more private graveside committal of his complex and controversial old friend's body, a fitting end to a relationship that had drawn him further into the political vortex than any other of his flirtations with power, and in the process had shown him the dangers of trying to swim in a whirlpool. In another manifestation of his role as the people's pastor, Graham joined President Clinton in a moving prayer service in the aftermath of the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Office Building in April 1995. In May 1996, the U.S. Congress honored Billy and Ruth Graham by presenting them with a Congressional Gold Medal, the highest honor Congress can bestow on a citizen. The first citizen to receive the award was George Washington. Only 112 others had been so honored in more than 2 centuries. This was only the second time the award had gone to a clergyman, and the third time it had been given to a couple. Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who hosted the event, attended by more than 700 congressional, diplomatic, and religious leaders, called Graham one of the great civic leaders of the 20th century, and lauded him and Ruth for having given up their lives as a model for serving humanity and standing as role models for generations to come. Gingrich added, "By receiving this medal, you join about as exalted a group of citizens as we have in this country, and you frankly honor us by being here to receive it." Physically frail and obviously moved by such tribute, Graham responded by saying, "As Ruth and I receive this award, we know that someday we will lay it at the feet of the one we seek to serve." In addition to the several phases of Mission World, and despite progressive physical decline brought on by what was thought to be Parkinson's, Graham maintained a relatively full schedule of crusades during the last decade of the century. Though most of these lasted only 3 to 5 nights instead of the 8 days that had been customary in the 1980s. On what amounted to a decade-long farewell tour, he brought his team and his message to New Jersey, New York, 3 cities in Scotland, Philadelphia, Portland, Pittsburgh, Tokyo, Cleveland, Toronto, Minneapolis, Charlotte, San Antonio, Ottawa, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Nashville, and Jacksonville, breaking stadium records in almost every city. None of these gatherings drew more national attention than an afternoon in the park with Billy on September 22, 1991, as the conclusion to the 3-year mission New York that began in Buffalo and included major events in Albany and on Long Island. Graham climaxed a successful crusade at the Meadowlands in neighboring New Jersey. Topping popular singer Bruce Springsteen's former record turnout for that venue by more than 10,000 people, with a 3-hour music and message extravaganza on the 15-acre Great Lawn of Manhattan's Central Park. At least one New York City official scoffed at hearing that Graham and his team were hoping for as many as 50,000 people to show up for the event. "Surely their draw in the Northeast is not what it's going to be in the South," he said. "But this is New York City." Evidently unaware of Graham's earlier success at bringing the gospel to Gotham and Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, and other locations far from the Bible Belt, this gentleman also failed to recognize that if BGEA representatives were publicly setting a goal of 50,000, they probably had already confirmed bus reservations for at least 75,000. It was never their practice to set themselves up for public disappointment. And they certainly did not intend to do so in full view of the nation's major media. Preparation had been extensive. Beyond the standard measures, 2.5 million brochures had been distributed house to house in all 5 boroughs of the city. In contrast, in 1957, when Catholics were urged to stay away from Billy Graham's Madison Square Garden crusade, and priests were provided materials to help them counter evangelical teaching, on this occasion in 1991, John Cardinal O'Connor, Archbishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of New York, and Bishop Thomas V. Daley of the Diocese of Brooklyn, wrote to their priests in 630 Catholic churches, urging them to invite their parishioners to go hear Billy Graham and encourage the distribution of brochures to hundreds of daily visitors to St. Patrick's Cathedral. In addition to greater participation by African-American churches than in earlier years, at least 100 Chinese churches actively promoted the event to their members. Once again, thorough planning, extravagant publicity, and the prospect of hearing the world's most famous evangelist preach from the front porch of America's cultural capital produced an astonishing result. By police estimates, 250,000 people turned out for what the New York Daily News called the largest religious assembly in New York City history. It was also more than twice as large as any audience ever to hear Graham in the United States. Mayor David Dinkins called it perhaps the most multicultural revival meeting the world has ever seen. More than 200 reporters crowded into the press area. The New York Times gave it glowing front-page coverage, and the Wall Street Journal exclaimed that we live in a time when such a large gathering turning out for a religious message is a phenomenon. No other domestic event matched the Central Park rally in terms of a live audience. The crusades of the 1990s were not simply formulaic reprises of what had gone before. Increasingly, crusade budgets included $50,000 to $100,000 in funds for distribution through social service agencies. Collections of food and other items for the hungry and homeless became standard. At the Philadelphia Crusade in 1992, 100,000 pounds of food was donated for distribution through local agencies, and 35,000 personal care kits containing a variety of hygiene products were assembled and distributed to homeless people in Philadelphia and in Chester, Pennsylvania, and Camden, New Jersey. That crusade also continued a growing emphasis on developing a multicultural appeal, as the 7,400-voice choir sang hymns in English and Spanish and Korean. While these changes were significant, they were mild compared to what, starting in Cleveland in 1994, would become a hallmark of Billy Graham crusades during the last years of his public ministry. Recall that Graham first gained national and international attention with Youth for Christ, which featured vital young men dressed in loud clothes and accompanied by contemporary music, and such novelties as a horse that could tap out the number of Jesus' apostles or the number of persons in the Trinity. As Graham and neo-evangelical Christianity matured and entered the mainstream, this youthful exuberance disappeared. The Graham team made a conscious effort to fashion services that would be thoroughly familiar to their middle-class constituency and would reassure backsliders and those who had never made a Christian commitment that coming forward at a Billy Graham crusade would plug them back into a community and cultural experience quite similar to what most of them had known in their youth. By the 1990s, however, high proportions of those attending the crusades, and more importantly, of the younger generations Graham particularly wanted to reach, had never been to a little brown church in the Wildwood, and would not likely regard an invitation just to trust and obey as a particularly appealing offer. As Graham spoke of what evangelicals call a burden for young people in his grandchildren's generation, he found a receptive spirit in Rick Marshall, a crusade director with several teenage youngsters. Marshall had felt for some time that crusade services were not meeting the needs of young people, and that a crucial step would be to introduce more music of the sort they enjoyed. Predictably, Billy Graham had no feel for the contemporary music scene, but he observed that when he went into different countries and cultures, he often needed an interpreter to put his message into a language people could understand. If popular music, however jarring to his own ears, could serve as a medium of translation, he was willing to give it a try. The experiment was launched in June 1994 in Cleveland's venerable municipal stadium. Marshall enlisted popular Christian musicians Michael W. Smith and rock group DC Talk and publicized the event on MTV and the two most popular rock stations in the Cleveland market. Instead of having these artists simply sing a number or two and give a brief testimony, the idea was to have them present a full concert of high-energy music, then follow that with a message from Billy Graham, a caring adult who would attempt to let them know that he understood their world and wanted to help them find purpose and meaning in their lives. Ted Smith, who by this time had assumed the lead role in producing the actual crusade program, admitted that we didn't know what was going to happen in Cleveland. I think there was some hesitation. Is this going to work? People who had been around so many years and had not been in a concert atmosphere wondered, are they going to behave? The answer to the first concern, will they show up, came early. 5 hours before the concert was to start, an estimated 50,000 kids were waiting to get into the stadium. That sight hardly eased the concerns about behavior. Larry Ross, who now had primary responsibility for Graham's public relations, recalled that Roger Flessing, by then in charge of BGEA Media, but still something of a free spirit, had provided his crew with T-shirts that read, "The Billy Graham It Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time Tour." In a similar spirit of giddy anxiety, Ross and several others sported clip-on earrings backstage. As the time for Graham to go on approached, Ross peeked out from backstage to see a mass of young humanity pogoing in front of the stage and a wave whipping around the upper deck of the stadium. Later he remembered thinking, "There is no way we are going to get control of this crowd. What are we going to do?" But then when Mr. Graham got up to speak, they settled down and you could hear a pin drop. Whether it is the grandfatherly image or the respect for his generation, I don't know, but it was amazing. And it's like that everywhere we go. Ted Smith gave a similar account. "We've never had anything like drugs," he observed. "When the music is on, the kids are listening, doing what they do at a concert. Then here comes Granddaddy on stage. The musicians give Billy Graham a hug. The kids say, 'Oh, gee, these guys are hugging him. He's a good person.' And all of a sudden, they become very, very quiet. We have found that in every single city. What he says is very much what they want to hear." Clearly, the experiment was a success, and youth night became a standard feature of Graham Crusades, as did a Saturday morning kids gig aimed at younger children, and often drawing upwards of 20,000 kids and their parents for a Christian music review featuring Salty, the singing songbook, a cartoon character popular in evangelical circles. In a remarkably short time, Michael W. Smith, Kirk Franklin, DC Talk, Jars of Clay, Third Day, Stephen Curtis Chapman, Crystal Lewis, Ricky Skaggs, the Gaither Vocal Band, the Tommy Coombs Band, Dennis Agajanian, and the Praise Band, and other young Christian musicians were just as likely to be part of a Billy Graham crusade as were Sandy Patty or Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. Ross acknowledged that not all of the old guard were easily won over. It has been tough. Let's put it this way. It has been an education process. Though they were very progressive in the early days, this was a whole genre of music they were not used to. An observation underscored by watching team members remove earplugs and grimace as they tried to communicate through the noise coming from the stage. The team was not alone. Franklin noted that Daddy is not too comfortable with the music, or more pointedly, Daddy doesn't like it. He won't even listen to it. But he's willing to give it a try. They're stocking the pond so he can go fishing. The old evangelist was also willing to adjust his preaching to a new audience. Instead of hauling out a classic sermon about King Manasseh, the wickedest man who ever lived, he preached about Solomon, the richest, most powerful, and sexiest man of his time, moving somewhat beyond strict exegesis of Scripture to assert that Solomon had several PhDs from the universities of his day and used drugs, not to mention all those wives and concubines, but still could not find happiness in pleasure and power. Instead of quoting Reader's Digest or a world leader he had personally known, he cited MTV and shared nuggets of disillusionment from the lead singer of Nine Inch Nails and the rapping Notorious B.I.G., or referred to Kurt Cobain's widely publicized suicide. In city after city, Youth Night not only consistently drew the largest crowd for the crusade, but set stadium records in almost every venue. 78,000 in Atlanta, 73,500 in Toronto, 82,000 in Minneapolis, 88,000 in Charlotte, 75,000 in San Antonio, 70,000 in Jacksonville, and so it went. In 1996, a special Youth Night television special was translated in 48 languages and sent to 160 countries. While asserting that these programs have become not only a hallmark for his ministry, but a model for pastors who are trying to reach this generation, Larry Ross admitted that the phenomenon continued to amaze him. Sometimes, he said, chuckling and shaking his head, they will chant, "Billy! Billy! Billy!" for a minute or two before they settle down, and then they hang on every word. To have an 82-year-old evangelist setting stadium attendance records on Youth Night, go figure. I think it just confirms the search for meaning. The Youth Night programs had another quite visible effect on Billy Graham crusades. To accommodate the bands and such high-tech items as the Jumbotron screens, the stage settings underwent radical transformation. Before Youth Nights began, the standard setting was a simple draped platform with several rows of chairs for key committee personnel, local clergy, and various dignitaries. Sometimes in outdoor venues, a small canopy might be erected over the pulpit to protect the evangelist from sun or rain. In the new arrangement, the stage resembled those erected for major rock concerts, with a huge box-like superstructure that stretched with the screens and protective fencing almost completely across the end zone of a football stadium and extended 80 feet upward. This provided protection from the elements and lent a much more theatrical air to the event. The rows of chairs for dignitaries were gone. Only the few people with key roles appeared on the stage. Musicians entered through a curtain at the rear and performed before large screens that could be illuminated in dramatic ways, then lifted out of the way by cables when the performance ended. Billy Graham still spoke from a simple pulpit, a tiny, even lonely figure on a huge soundstage. Yet as he summoned his strength and began to preach, it was easy to forget the new trappings and to remember the old days when he dominated the platform. even though that memory would have been far dimmer had his audience not been able to view him on the huge screens on each side of the stageworks. As had been the case for more than a half century of public ministry, the old evangelist was still anchored to the rock, geared to the times. Apparently, Graham's appeal to youth was not limited to evangelical circles. In 1999, two addresses at Harvard drew capacity crowds. At the John F. Kennedy School of Government, where he spoke on the relevance of God in the 21st century, he received a long-standing ovation from students and faculty after his address and 40-minute question and answer session. The demand to hear him was so great that a lottery system was used to select those allowed to attend the event. The only other person to require such a measure that year was Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota. During the same visit, Graham spoke at Memorial Church in Harvard Yard. No lottery was used, but many students spent the night on the front steps of the church to make sure they could get seats the next morning. The Reverend Peter Gomes, a university minister and himself an unusually able and eloquent preacher, said Graham's sermon on the meaning of the cross was one of the highlights of his 25-year career at Harvard. The visit received extensive positive coverage in the college newspaper, the Harvard Crimson, not usually regarded as an evangelical organ. Of all Billy Graham's efforts to encourage the spread of the Christian gospel throughout the world, it is possible that none meant more to him, or ultimately will prove to have greater impact, than the mammoth Amsterdam conferences for itinerant evangelists. The 1983 and 1986 conferences described earlier in this book, together with numerous small regional conferences organized along the same lines, have trained tens of thousands of evangelists from all over the world in the arts, crafts, and commitment required to fulfill their calling in an effective manner. Glowing reports from participants in these programs regarding the efficacy of this training continue to support the view that the answer to the oft-asked question, who will be the next Billy Graham, is not a single towering figure, but the thousands of men and women trained by BGEA to carry on his kind of ministry, not in great stadiums or via synchronous orbit satellite, but in the highways and byways of the world, largely unknown outside their modest spheres. It was fitting, then, that the capstone to Billy Graham's ministry was Amsterdam 2000, an expanded version of the earlier conferences. This 9-day gathering, held in July and August 2000, involved 10,732 participants from 209 countries and territories. It was undoubtedly the most international conference in the history of the world. 3/4 of these men and women, while women constituted only 8% of the total, they were still present by the hundreds, were from developing nations, and most of these, approximately 7,000 in all, lived in the same mass dormitory in Utrecht that had been used in the earlier conferences. Once again, preference was given to evangelists in the presumed prime of their careers, between ages 25 and 45, and to those whose formal educational opportunities had been limited. The 22 plenary sessions featured many of the familiar luminaries: Ravi Zacharias, Billy Kim, Louis Palau, Stephen Olford, J.I. Packer, John Stott, Bill and Vanette Bright, Charles Colson, Franklin Graham, Anne Graham Lotz, and George Carey, Archbishop of Canterbury, among others. Hundreds of other evangelical stalwarts led 130 seminars and more than 200 workshops. To his great disappointment, and certainly to that of the participants, Billy Graham himself was unable to attend due to a setback in the treatment of his disease, now re-diagnosed as hydrocephalus, which produces Parkinson's-like symptoms. He did, however, watch the plenary sessions over the Internet, and Franklin delivered the message his father had prepared for the opening session of the conference. In addition to the larger enrollment, Amsterdam 2000 went beyond its two predecessors by widening the scope of its concern to include elements addressed by the other BGEA-supported international conferences, Berlin and Lausanne. Echoing the concerns of the 1966 Berlin Conference, a church leaders task group focused on ways churches might become more evangelistic and cooperate more effectively with independent evangelists. Recalling the 1974 Lausanne Conference's call for greater sensitivity to cultural differences, a theologian's task group concentrated on problems encountered by evangelists trying to proclaim a uniform gospel message in a pluralistic world. A third contingent, the strategist task group, focused on ways of implementing more fully Jesus' Great Commission, developing specific strategies to plant churches by the end of 2002 in each of 253 population groups designated as unreached peoples. At the end of the conference, these task groups produced what they called the Amsterdam Declaration, a charter for evangelism in the 21st century, comprising a list of 14 pledges they urged upon those called to evangelistic ministry. Like the previous conferences, the final session of Amsterdam 2000 included a massive communion service. Richard Bewes, rector of All Souls Church, Langham Place, London, who officiated at that service, did not exaggerate when he called it the most internationally representative Christian service of all time. The thousands of participants for whom Billy Graham was a legendary hero were understandably disappointed at not having a chance to see him in person. BGEA family itself, however, suffered a greater sadness. Bob Williams, who had played a major role in all three of the Amsterdam conferences, had contracted pulmonary fibrosis, a serious lung disease, during the course of his travels for the association as Director of International Ministries. Although seriously restricted by this condition, Williams remained heavily involved in the planning and oversight of this last great effort, all the while wearing a special pager that would notify him the moment a lung became available for transplant. The call never came. Bob Williams, age 51, died on August 7, one day after the close of Amsterdam 2000. Chapter 39. Guard what has been entrusted to you. Bob Williams' death was untimely, but the Graham organization had been confronted with the realities of aging and death for several years. No one had believed Billy Graham would live forever, but questions of who, if anyone, would succeed him at his passing and of what would happen to BGEA at that point had been difficult to face. Graham and some of his closest associates clearly hoped Franklin would assume the mantle as leader of the organization and perhaps even as primary evangelist, even though Franklin had expressed considerable ambivalence about taking either role. Others were less sanguine at the prospect of transferring their loyalty and devotion to a man whose style differed significantly from his father's, and who, some thought, had not yet fully proved he was ready to assume such a position. And understandably, many people who had grown comfortable with a system and organization that had shown remarkable stability over more than four decades were anxious at the prospect of any significant change. As an obscure but wise philosopher once remarked, when you start changing things, something different might happen. But when Billy Graham was diagnosed with serious progressive illness in 1992, the pressure to attend to BGEA's future began to mount, as it became increasingly clear that someday was unavoidably now at hand. Inevitably, Franklin Graham edged closer to center stage and the spotlight he had never seemed to crave. Franklin had been ordained in 1982, but he doubted the pulpit would be a major focus of his ministry, and he clearly did not aspire to follow in his father's footsteps as a crusade evangelist. In 1983, while he was assisting at a crusade in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, led by BGEA associate evangelist John Wesley White, White persuaded him to preach one evening, when not a single person in the crowd of approximately 1,000 responded to the invitation. Franklin was devastated. "Don't you ever ask me to do that again," he told White. "I'm not Billy Graham." He was serious. Not until 1989 did he preach in another crusade, and then only after strong urging from his friend, hunting companion, motorcycle buddy, and born-again country guitar picker, Dennis Agajanian, who gave him a rifle as an added inducement to join White in a crusade in Juneau, Alaska. The first effort in Juneau was hardly more successful than the Saskatoon outing. As Franklin told the story, only 9 people came forward, and 4 of them were Dennis Agajanian's friends. He wanted to make sure that somebody went up, Franklin recalled. I didn't find out about that until several years later. I asked him, Dennis, why in the world would you do that? If God is in this and we try to manipulate the invitation, God will curse us. He won't bless us. A night or two later, Franklin used one of his father's favorite sermons, and the unmanipulated response to that one was much better. Franklin took this as a sign. I realized that I had nothing to do with that. That was the Holy Spirit of God touching the lives of these people. They were responding to God's invitation. I went back to my room that night and said, God, if this is something you want me to do, I'll be glad to do it. I will make it the number one priority in my life, and I will do it as long as you will allow me to do it. But I will need your help. While he had no intention of shortchanging his work at Samaritan's Purse, Franklin pledged to devote one-tenth of his time to evangelistic preaching, and was soon holding 8 to 10 crusades around the world each year, at first alternating with John Wesley White, and later as sole preacher, to progressively larger crowds. The success of these crusades surprised no one more than Franklin Graham himself. In 1994, he told Ken Garfield of the Charlotte Observer that he had avoided evangelistic preaching because I didn't want to be compared to Daddy. There is enough pressure in life. I didn't need that one. And even with 5 years of preaching under his belt, he said, it's not that I want Daddy's mantle. The Lord in heaven called me to do it. Although convinced of his own call, Franklin understood that many people had come to hear him, at least during the early years of his evangelistic ministry, to see how he stacked up against his famous father. I don't know if I can avoid comparisons, he admitted. Billy Graham is my father. I'm his son. But he added, I love my father. How can you be tired of being compared to someone you love and admire so much? He frequently told his audiences that because I am the son of Billy Graham, that did not impress God one bit. But he realized it might impress others. So when he conducted a campaign in Australia in 1996, billboards proclaimed that over 40 years with Billy Graham makes him worth hearing. The family resemblance is clearly there, with the strong, classic features and piercing, direct gaze. His preaching style is nothing like his father's, early, spellbinding, Gatling gun delivery. But it had been decades since Billy's own preaching, tamed by television, had borne much resemblance to the impassioned oratory that took him to fame in the 1950s. Franklin calls his campaigns festivals instead of crusades, explaining that a crusade is not something unchurched people understand. What does that mean? A crusade for what? People understand festivals. You have beer festivals, art festivals, and music festivals. Albuquerque has a balloon festival. I would rather have a name that, if we're going to publicize something in the community, people will say, well, sure, if there's going to be a festival, I will be there. I majored in marketing. This is a way to attract people. You don't want to turn people off. You want them to taste your product. His festivals certainly have music and perhaps a few balloons, and Jumbotron screens flash with video clips aimed at holding his audience's attention. But the product they are invited to taste is hardly all milk and honey. While his services often resemble the youth nights in his father's crusades, he is quick to note the differences. Shortly before Billy Graham's Greater Louisville Crusade in June 2001, Franklin observed that Daddy's youth nights are a little more edgy than mine. We've had some discussions about that. It is not so much Daddy as it is the people around him that are pushing him in that direction. I think they have pushed Daddy a little too far. I know he has felt uncomfortable, and his board has felt uncomfortable. I have felt uncomfortable. For me, Billy Graham is a standard, and when Billy Graham does something, we're saying to the churches of America, this is okay. And churches will say, Billy Graham is doing it, so we can do it too. Some of these groups, you can't understand them, and I'm thinking, why do I want them? They make a noise. A crusade or festival should not be there solely to entertain. We should have good music, which is part of the magnet that helps attract people, but it has to be music that's focusing on what we want. If we lose that, if we bring groups that are just doing a gig, I don't want them. The key is having everything point to the cross, your music, your musicians, everything, so that when I stand up to preach, the platform has been set. Everything has to focus toward the Lord Jesus Christ and preparing people for that invitation. When he preaches, Franklin speaks directly and with authority. He has a good sense of humor, but relies little on jokes or other devices many preachers use to seduce and hold an audience. Instead, he moves quickly into the heart of his rather short sermons, identifying sins by name and warning that death and hell are their consequence, declaring what God has done through his Son to repair the breach between himself and fallen humanity, and calling on his audiences to repent at the foot of the cross, ask for the needed and promised forgiveness, and accept Christ as Lord of their lives. Whereas his father told of other people who rebelled against God, Franklin draws on his own biography. "For years I didn't want Jesus Christ in my life," he confesses. "I ran from him. I was afraid if I gave my life to him, I'd have a spiritual straitjacket all my life. I wanted to be free. I wanted to make myself happy. There was a lot of fun, no question, but there was an emptiness. There was a big hole in the middle of Franklin Graham." Accounts of wickedness overcome have long been a staple of evangelistic preaching. But Franklin's message of rebellion, fired by emptiness, obviously strikes a chord with his audiences, heavy populated with baby boomers and their offspring. Their awareness that Franklin was indeed a bit of a rebel, even if smoking, drinking, and driving fast do not hold the top positions in everyone's list of sins, provides an authentic touch. This image is undergirded by his having Dennis Agajanian, Ricky Skaggs, and other tough-looking contemporary musicians open his programs, and his own habit of preaching in jeans, boots, a black leather jacket, and a Harley-Davidson baseball cap. "I dress this way not because it's an image. I just enjoy it. When I was at the White House, I wore a suit. I know when to put a tie on." Most of his listeners also know that Franklin actually rides a Harley, flies his own plane into dangerous regions, and dodges artillery fire and sniper's bullets in his work with Samaritan's Purse, and once famously cut down a tree with more than 700 rounds from an assault rifle. The combination of being both William Franklin Graham III and Franklin Graham, rebel with a cause and Christian soldier of fortune, has powerful appeal, and Franklin has used his legacy, his license, and his liberty to good effect, drawing ever larger crowds to his services. As Billy Graham's medical problems continued their slow but inexorable course, the need to think seriously and concretely about the future of BGEA became more pressing. Franklin's expanding ministry, both in the pulpit and with Samaritan's Purse, had improved his stature among organization stalwarts and generated increasing speculation that he would eventually take the reins. According to Time, Ruth Graham became increasingly vocal in her belief that Franklin should eventually be his father's successor. Franklin apparently also thought it possible, and reportedly broached the subject with his father early in 1995. Apparently the elder Graham was not ready to make a decision. Some accounts say he rebuffed his son's inquiry. Franklin said only that, "While it was plausible that he might one day head BGEA, my father didn't say it to me." Neither did he say it to anyone else, at least publicly. However, the option to remain non-committal would soon be taken from him by circumstances beyond his control. In conversations among BGEA insiders, some words serve as shorthand for signal moments in Billy Graham's ministry. The Canvas Cathedral, Haringey, Madison Square Garden, Berlin, Lausanne, Amsterdam. For less glamorous reasons, Toronto joined that list in June 1995, at a standard appearance before a large civic club on the day before a crusade was scheduled to begin at Toronto's Sky Dome. Graham collapsed, felled by a bleeding colon. From his hospital bed, he asked T.W. Wilson to contact Franklin and ask him to take his place in the pulpit at the opening service. What followed is variously described, depending on one's place in the audience, backstage, or among the dramatis personae, as a series of innocent misunderstandings, an unattractive struggle for power, or less darkly, a mirthless comedy of errors. Wilson called Ruth Graham, who called Franklin and told him his father was ill and wanted him to preach in his stead. Franklin had returned from Rwanda the day before, and his plane was being serviced. but he quickly arranged for a substitute, and with his wife and daughter flew to Montreat the next morning to pick up Ruth, then headed for Toronto. Before leaving, Franklin had called his sister, Ann Lotz, and asked her to pray for him. Concerned about their father, and also recognizing the symbolic significance of having her brother step into the famed evangelist's shoes in a major international setting, with a spotlight at full wattage, Ann booked a flight and arrived in Toronto in mid-afternoon. Not long after she checked into her hotel, she received a call from a distraught Franklin, who told her he had just been informed that he would not be preaching that evening. Instead, associate evangelist Ralph Bell, an Ontario native, would fill in for their father. The decision had been made that morning, but no one had told Franklin when he was met at the airport. "My mother went straight to the hospital to see Daddy," Franklin recalled, "and I went to the hotel room to work on my notes." About 5 o'clock, 2 hours after BGA issued a press release naming Bell as the speaker for that evening, one of Daddy's aides dropped by my room and said, "Franklin, I've got to talk to you." Ann was furious and demanded to know who was responsible for this turn of events. Franklin wasn't sure, but gave her the names of the people he presumed were involved. The basic outlines of what happened next are not in much dispute. Ann and Franklin had emotional meetings with their father, with members of the Crusade Committee, and with key BGEA personnel, including Rick Marshall, who was directing the Toronto Crusade. Ann and Franklin thought it important that their father's wishes be honored. Marshall and the committee contended that Billy Graham Crusades had always been characterized as local events, and therefore the local committee should have the final say in such matters. The committee refused to change its decision, but would allow Franklin to bring a greeting from his father and give a brief report on his mission to Rwanda. They would get back to him the next day about whether he could preach at subsequent services. That evening, Franklin used his allotted time to give a quite brief evangelistic message rather than a report on Rwanda, and Ralph Bell preached as planned. The next morning, when representatives of the Crusade Committee tried to reach Franklin to tell him they wanted Bell to preach at the remaining services as well, they learned that he had already flown back to North Carolina. Beneath that consensus view of the known facts lie several conflicting explanations and attributions of motive. It appears that the Canadian committee did make the decision to ask Ralph Bell to fill in for Billy Graham, and when pressed by the younger Grahams, stood by their decision. Why they did so is less clear. Although Bell is a Canadian and had filled in for Graham on other occasions, some insiders doubt the local committee was even aware of that, and assert that BGEA representatives must have suggested him to the local committee. They also note that John Wesley White is a Canadian, but was apparently not mentioned as a candidate for the task, perhaps because he was known as one of Franklin's staunchest advocates. That the push for Bell as Billy's replacement came from inside BGEA also fits with a report that the chairman of the local committee claimed not to have known of Billy Graham's wish until he met with Ann and Franklin. Those who feel the decision to go with Bell was at least defensible point to BGA's tradition of local control of the Crusades, but they also speculate that both Rick Marshall and the local committee probably felt it unwise. After long months of extensive and expensive preparation, to turn Billy Graham's pulpit over to a relatively unseasoned evangelist, even if he did have his father's name, genes, and blessing, Franklin and those who take his side have a less sanguine view. Franklin questioned both the behavior and motive of those who had countered his father's request. He and Ann certainly understood the potential symbolic power involved in picking up his fallen father's mantle at an event already making international news because of Billy's collapse. "That's what some people were afraid of," he said. "I was honored that my father wanted me to preach, that he thought I was ready to fill in for him. I don't think my father's crusade directors were loyal to him. That is what he asked for, and they didn't support him." In an interview not long after that event, Franklin showed his awareness that religious organizations, even those with the finest reputations, are not immune to the forces that characterize worldly organizations. Noting that control of BGEA's $90 million annual budget could provide significant incentive to those wanting to shape the organization's and their own future, he said. Listen, people will shoot you for $20. For $90 million? Who knows? It is worth noting that no one believed Ralph Bell had a hand in stirring the pot. And Anna said that Bell encouraged her to try to persuade the committee to let Franklin preach. By all accounts, Bell acquitted himself admirably, in and out of the pulpit, throughout this trying time, preaching to huge crowds each of the first three nights. Billy Graham recovered sufficiently to preach at the last two services. Franklin's family and friends worried about the impact this would have on him. Years later, both Anne and Franklin acknowledged that she had displayed more open outrage than he, and she speculated that perhaps both her presence and anger had been providential. Franklin handled it so well, she said, but I feel like maybe God had me there to go with him, and that for me to be outraged helped him. He was concerned with calming me down, so maybe I was able to vent some of the anger he felt and also stand by him. Less angry than concerned, BGEA photographer Russ Busby sat down with Franklin a few days later and told him, I don't know what happened, but there is one thing you need to consider. What really matters is what happens inside us. Don't let this turn you bitter against God or anyone else. Make sure in your own heart that you've got it worked out, because that's where the problem could lie. For a time, Franklin insisted that he did not know the details of the Toronto affair, that he never wanted to learn them, and further, that it really didn't matter. But years later, in a softer mood, he acknowledged, there have been politics for a number of years in BGEA, and at some point there were people who worked very hard, I won't say against me, but they certainly didn't work for me. He recalled a widely publicized dispute between Samaritan's Purse and the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability in 1992, questioned by the watchdog group for some of his organization's accounting practices and for his personal use of the company plane. Franklin withdrew Samaritan's Purse from the ECFA in April 1992, dismissing the investigation as the work of crummy little evangelical busybodies who were jealous of his success. He insisted that ECFA cannot hold up one piece of paper, not one document, and say, this is where we got him. They can't do it. Whatever problems existed were cleared up quickly, and Samaritan's Purse membership in ECFA was reinstated in January 1993. 2 years later, the organization's president dismissed it as a bump in the road, and now it's gone. Looking back, Franklin saw it as part of an effort to sidetrack his ascension to leadership of BGEA. That whole thing with ECFA, he said, was all political. It was an effort by some people to tarnish Franklin. We don't want to destroy him, but let's taint him so that he's not in the running, so that his credibility is blackened a little bit. The awkwardness and tension generated by the turmoil in Toronto forced Billy Graham to recognize that by leaving questions of succession and leadership unresolved, he ran the risk of having members of his team, long noted for its harmony and relative lack of infighting, split into factions that could undercut its effectiveness after he passed from the scene. This would hurt not only the organization he had led for nearly half a century, but the entire evangelical world. A few months later, Graham took action. First, he joined Franklin in a father and son crusade in Saskatoon, which coincided with the publication of Franklin's autobiography, Rebel with a Cause, finally comfortable with being Graham. That symbolic joint lifting of the torch was followed shortly afterward on November 7 by the BGEA's board electing Franklin to the newly created position of first vice chairman, with direct succession to become chairman and CEO should his father ever become incapacitated. Billy Graham retained his position as chairman of the association, but Franklin gradually took increased responsibility and in November 2000 was officially named CEO. John Courts remained as president and continued to oversee the Minneapolis operation on a day-to-day basis, but Franklin began to spend more time at the headquarters and to take a real leadership role. In January 2002, Courts retired, and Franklin assumed the additional role of BGEA president. Not long after it became clear that Franklin would eventually head the ministry, a BGEA veteran advised him to keep one thing in mind. Most of the people in the Minneapolis office honestly believe, and I believe with them, that they have given their lives to your father's ministry, and through that, to God. Don't lose sight of that. Whatever differences you may have with them, keep in mind that they really have dedicated their lives to your father's ministry and to God's work. Franklin appeared to have heard that counsel, volunteering that with BGEA we have a leadership that is older and retiring. I'm coming in and trying not to step on toes and slowly trying to fit in. Those who knew Franklin best recognized the potential for friction because of both his new authority and his old personality. Soon after he was named vice chairman and successor, a cousin, Mel Graham, observed that the handful that would resist Franklin clearly see him as a threat. Uncle Billy has got a lot more timid, a lot more easygoing here in his later years. And Franklin is a man of action. If somebody's chain needs to be jerked, he'll jerk it. No one doubts that Franklin is more direct and less averse to conflict than was his father, but most observers give him high marks, improving significantly over time for his sensitivity both to his father's continuing position as the dominant figure in the association and to the predictable anxiety felt by people about possible changes in the roles they had occupied for decades, and perhaps even about how secure their positions would be in a new regime. One BGA staffer attributed what difficulty existed not only to normal resistance to change on the part of entrenched team veterans, but also to Billy Graham's reluctance to cede control even in the face of clearly diminished abilities. We have a relay race, and the guy who created the baton and has been carrying it for 50 years has come to the point where he ought to hand it off, but he wants to take another lap. That has been a problem. Some of the people who are extremely loyal to him and to the ways we've always done things want to point out everything that Franklin is going to do or trying to do or thought about doing or mentioned in an elevator, and when they bring it up to Billy, he says he's not sure about that. But when you pin him down, he says, sure, that's what I want to do. I think eventually it is going to work out fine. But has it been a model transition? No, I think everybody would say that. Russ Busby also acknowledged Billy Graham's difficulty in passing the baton, but felt he had loosened his grip sufficiently by mid-2001 to effect a relatively smooth transfer. It took a little bit of time, but I think God has given Mr. Graham peace about this. I think he has peace about Franklin's motives for preaching. They are not, from my viewpoint, self-serving. I don't think he's ever wanted to run the Billy Graham Association. He's got his own organization. But in the present situation, someone needs to take over. I think Billy also had some concern as to whether Franklin was ready for it. And when it is your own son, you want to make sure this is right, that you are not pushing your son into a place God has not prepared for him. In my mind, that would have been Billy's biggest concern. I think he has peace about that now. I also think God has worked in Franklin's life and accomplished what needed to be done there for him to take over. In my mind, God has put his stamp of approval on Franklin. Without a doubt, the spectacular growth and success of Samaritan's Purse greatly enhanced Franklin's standing in the evangelical world and helped convince skeptics that he had the ability to run BGEA. In fiscal year 2001, Samaritan's Purse income topped $179 million, including nearly $24 million from its Canadian affiliate. This outstripped BGEA revenues by approximately $62 million, a bracing response to those who feared that Franklin would never be able to attract the financial support that had come to his father. Audited statements reveal that 91% of Samaritan's Purse income was expended on ministry, an admirably high proportion for any nonprofit organization. The organization's facilities are extensive, modern, and comfortable, but neither lavish nor designed to draw attention to or pay homage to their leader. Located several miles from Boone, North Carolina, the complex is not only rather difficult to find, but has no signage to indicate one has arrived. A visit to the ministry's website, www.samaritanspurse.org reveals the impressive range and scope of its efforts to bring relief and support for people in need around the world. In the wake of hurricanes, earthquakes, and tsunamis in Central America, Turkey, India, Indonesia, and the U.S. Gulf Coast, Samaritan's Purse has airlifted emergency supplies such as food, blankets, and temporary shelters, then followed up by building thousands of durable one-room homes, a project so impressive that the U.S. government aid program funneled money through the organization to build additional houses. In other initiatives, the ministry has built an orphanage in Moldova, set up a big water filtering project in Ethiopia, helped establish a silk production industry in Laos by distributing 600,000 mulberry saplings to provide food for silkworms, to help families increase their income, delivered plane loads of food, medicine, and supplies to homeless people in Rwanda and to refugees in Afghanistan, and dispatched hundreds of medical professionals to different parts of the world as volunteers under its medical arm, World Medical Mission. In 2012, the organization sent disaster relief units and hundreds of volunteers to help survivors of Hurricane Sandy. Greg Laurie, a noted California evangelist and pastor and member of the Samaritan's Purse Board, observed that Franklin will go into virtually impossible situations and get something done. He won't take no for an answer. For several years, Samaritan's Purse has been heavily involved in Sudan in response to pleas from southern Sudanese Christians who had suffered atrocities at the hands of their own countrymen, mostly northern Muslims who have killed nearly 2 million of them and have tortured and displaced millions more, even selling them into slavery. Flying into areas officially off-limits to international agencies, Samaritan's Purse pilots delivered emergency supplies that included bags of maize and sorghum seeds, staples of the Sudanese diet, basic medical supplies, mosquito nets dipped in natural insecticide to help ward off malaria, and tools to help refugees reestablish their lives. In 2014, the organization distributed more than 1,500 metric tons of food each month to nearly 90,000 people in refugee camps in the region. Opened in September 1997, the 80-bed Samaritan's Purse Hospital, staffed primarily by international volunteer medical professionals working for a few weeks at a time, has treated more than 100,000 patients in an area that had been without adequate medical care for more than two decades. The hospital has been bombed repeatedly, killing some personnel because of his organization's work in Sudan. Franklin Graham was asked to testify before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he called on the United States to join with other world powers to bring down what he regarded as an illegitimate government. In February 2002, Franklin took on a significant and to some surprising challenge when Samaritan's Purse, in cooperation with BGEA and at a cost of $2.3 million, organized Prescription for Hope, an international Christian conference on HIV/AIDS that drew more than 900 frontline AIDS workers, church and government leaders, and medical providers from 87 countries to Washington, D.C. During the 5 days of the conference, which featured such speakers as Senators Jesse Helms, Republican North Carolina, and Bill Frist, Republican Tennessee, and the First Lady of Uganda, Janet Museveni, Franklin called on Christians to show Christ-like care and compassion for the infected and affected. This was not simply an attention-grabbing venture. Since 2002, Samaritan's Purse has worked with AIDS patients and their families in more than 42 countries. In another bold effort to fight a deadly epidemic, Samaritan's Purse attracted international acclaim in 2014 when its extensive efforts to combat Ebola outbreak in Liberia led to its being named, along with a small number of other organizations, as Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Interestingly, and in contrast to these dramatic, often life-saving efforts, a program that began in 1993 as a heartwarming little venture to brighten a few children's lives at Christmas time has become Samaritan's Purse's largest program, at least from a budgetary standpoint. The program, known as Operation Christmas Child, is simple in its essence. Donors, mostly children from affluent Western countries, pack a shoebox with candy, small toys, school supplies, and perhaps a pair of socks or mittens, and send it to Boone along with $9 to cover shipping costs. After being checked at large processing centers in Boone and Charlotte to make sure they contain no inappropriate items such as food that might spoil or dangerous or inappropriate toys, the boxes are securely wrapped, then packed with others for eventual distribution to children in countries ravaged